Well, are you all staying warm? Trying? Diabetes, the butter with the sweetener. Yeah, it does appear to be somewhat of a mistake there, huh? Sometimes we talk about the bitter with the sweet because not everything's going well. But this is no mistake. It is the butter with the sweet. And I hope by the time we get to the end of this talk, you understand why we chose that title. Well, March 1, 1954, the United States tested the largest atom bomb they would ever test in the history of bomb testing, and they tested it in the South Pacific in the Marshall Islands. This thing was 1,000 times larger than the bomb they dropped on Hiroshima. Scientists around the world said, "Don't do it. You don't know what'll happen. It might start a chain reaction and it'll blow the whole planet up." But undaunted, the United States government went to one of these islands, made a deal with the chief, moved all the folks off the island, set up this bomb, and prepared to blow it off. It was going to be blown off early in the morning, and as the time for its detonation arrived, the wind was in the wrong direction. They say they had more cameras, movie cameras, in place to watch this thing go off than all the cameras in Hollywood. Well, they said, "We're not going to be deterred now, we got too much at stake, let's go ahead and blow it off." And they pushed the button. This thing sent a cloud of fire 100,000 feet into the air. That's three times as high as most commercial airplanes fly. It made so much heat that gale-force winds started blowing across the ocean for miles. And, well, this was disaster for surrounding islands. Pretty soon, some of the surrounding islands experienced typhoon-level winds. Palm branches were blown off of palm trees, and roofs were blown off of houses. This was a big disaster. Well, the Marshallese, not expecting such a thing on the other islands, started investigating what was going on. When they discovered what had happened, they decided to take the United States to court. They sued them. Well, the United States capitulated. Okay. And they handed out cash to everyone on all the islands. Well, what do you do with cash out in the middle of nowhere on a South Pacific island? Well, nothing. And so pretty soon they had to start importing things they could use the money on. Pretty soon they had a bigger bomb on their hands than the atom bomb. They had a junk food bomb, crinkly packages floating around the islands. And people's diets changing en masse. Their traditional diet had been tropical fruit, vegetables, and fish. Now, guess what? Frozen turkey tails, Spam, convenience foods high in fat, salt, and sugar, and low in nutrition. Very low in nutrition. Well, this is a problem. You know, when you're not eating good food, diseases start cropping up. Type 2 diabetes was unheard of in the Pacific Islands, not just the Marshall Islands, but the other islands affected by the war before World War II. They didn't have it. Well, now 30% of the people over 15 are diabetic, 50% of the people over 50, resulting in high rates of complications, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, kidney and eye disease, and amputations. I had a friend that wanted to go over there and work in their hospital until they discovered that their training was totally inadequate in the area of wound care for amputations. You know, amputations are one of the reasons why I got involved in diabetes. Yep, they kept sending me the patients to have the legs chopped off. Well, how do you successfully remove somebody's leg? I mean, that's not like a great surgery. And so I went and watched Weimar for a while do their reversing diabetes program. Well, okay, I thought diabetes was inherited. So who did the Marshallese inherit it from? The Americans. They're grocers, actually, right? And so it's not really inherited. In America, we've seen a dramatic increase in the amount of diabetes. Notice that in 1980, we had about 6 million diabetics. By the time we went 25 years later to 2005, that number had risen to nearly 21 million. And has our population in America tripled in the last 25 years? No, or we'd have a billion people on the continent. So it's definitely, well, okay, maybe the diabetics are having more children than everybody else. Remarkably more reproductive, huh? No, we know that's not true because diabetics have a hard time having children. So we're definitely doing something to ourselves to create this disease. And the complications, all that money that those Marshallese have received does nothing to defray the costs of all these complications. You have heart disease and stroke killing 80% of them. You have high blood pressure affecting 73%. It's the number one cause of blindness in America with 24,000 new cases each year from macular degeneration and retinopathy. And then it affects all the nerves, and some people get to carpal tunnel. Some people get pain or numbness in the hands or feet. We call peripheral neuropathy. And sometimes it affects the digestion of food, where food digestion controlled by nerves is slowed. So it affects a lot of things. And what about these amputations? Here we are with a gentleman missing something here for sure. But if you look closely, this is an artificial leg also. And most of the time, when diabetics lose both legs, they have a hard time walking. They don't have a leg to stand on. 10 times the risk of amputation. 81,000 amputations in 2001. And so you can see this is a big problem. It affects the mood. It affects the memory. It affects the personality. We had a gentleman came to stay with us. His wife was getting harder and harder to get along with. He finally decided the old lady had to go. He was going to divorce her. Then they checked his blood sugar and discovered it was going too high. And once his blood sugar was under control and his personality returned to normal, he decided that, well, maybe he would keep the wife. Maybe she wasn't so bad after all. And makes your brain shrink. Also, it shortens your life, 12 to 14 years. A lot of pneumonias and even the flu can be the cause of death. And it increases your risk of going to the nursing home in middle age. In fact, it triples the risk of ending up in the nursing home in middle age. I've had patients who were seeing me for other reasons, like arthritis. And after we got through taking care of their arthritis and we're just talking, they're telling me about their lives, and they're telling me they volunteer down at the local nursing home, and then they get this funny look, and they're in their 80s, and they say, and you know, I'm older than anybody out there. Because there's a lot of diabetics in that place. I had a lady tell me that she wished I was up in Maryland talking in a certain town because her daughter was in the nursing home. And the lady didn't look that old herself, and I'm thinking, well, what's your daughter doing in the nursing home? I said, well, why is your daughter in the nursing home? She said, well, she got diabetes and she got all these complications, and they put her in the nursing home. Earliest records of diabetes date back to the pyramids. You know, we've learned a lot from the mummies. Those Egyptians had a lot of the diseases that we have today. And in some of the hieroglyphics or pictographs, they described all the signs and symptoms of diabetes. So back in 1552 BC, they had diabetes. Now, can you think of some people who were in Egypt besides Egyptians, probably building those pyramids in 1552 BC? Yes, the Israelites. That's right. And it's very interesting that when God finally let the Israelites go, gave them their emancipation, their exodus, that he gave them specific instructions. He said, if thou wilt diligently hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, I will put none of these diseases upon thee which I have brought upon the Egyptians. Well, and they had diabetes. So apparently he had told them something that if they totally followed it, they could avoid diabetes. Well, we'll get back to that. But first of all, what is diabetes? Well, diabetes is too much sugar in the blood, too much sugar in the urine. Have you ever met somebody that was just a little too sweet? Well, that's these folks. Much too sweet. And, well, how much is too much? If we look at a fasting blood test, some of you did this at the beginning of the week, fasting blood test, taking your blood before breakfast, then a normal should be between 70 and 99. That's good. You want to stay in that range. If you start going over that range, between 100 and 125, we call you pre-diabetic. Now, you've heard of preschool, and most people that go to preschool go on to school. And, well, most people that are pre-diabetic go on to full-blown diabetes, which would be 126 or above. So that's the numbers you want to look at. Well, okay, so diabetes is too much sugar in the blood, too much sugar in the urine. So it stands to reason that the cause of diabetes must be eating sugar, right? Well, that's what Dr. James Anderson of Kentucky State University thought. He looked at this and he said, well, let's figure out how much sugar it does take to make somebody diabetic. And so he got a hold of a bunch of what we call military white coats, people who have sort of decided rather than carrying a gun, they'd be a guinea pig, and fed them 2 pounds of sugar a day. I emailed him. I said, did you feed those guys 1 pound of sugar a day? He emailed back. He said, no, it was 2 pounds of sugar a day. Go read the article. I said, okay, I'll do that. And 1 week went by, no change in blood sugar, no change in urinary glucose output. 2 weeks, no signs of diabetes. 3 weeks, 13 weeks later, and no signs of diabetes. He said over time they seem to handle the sugar better and better. Well, I mean, if you did this for a whole year, they'd probably get fat and get diabetes from that, but apparently this wasn't working in 13 weeks. Other researchers got involved. They decided, well, if it's not sugar, let's try something else. Let's look at fat. And so fat became the studied commodity. And here's dietary fat source across the bottom. Here's percent increase risk of diabetes. If you're getting most of the fat in your diet from vegetable sources, and that fat in the vegetables, not from bottles, then, and it's low fat, say 17% of your calories, then your risk of diabetes does not go up appreciably. But if you're getting lots of fat from any source, of course this is usually free fats, then your risk of diabetes goes up 40%. Now, certain fats that are especially dangerous, such as trans fat, and so 3% of your calories coming from trans fat will increase your risk of diabetes 44%. Now, if you had a bottle of extra virgin, cold-pressed, cold-processed olive oil, and you're sitting at home with nothing more than your usual kitchen utensils, how could you make trans fat out of your olive oil? That's right, just heat it up, put it in a frying pan, and you can make trans fat right then and there. So when they outlawed trans fat in the restaurants in New York City, good luck. I mean, you can take the best olive oil in there you want, but by the time they're through frying with it, they've been making trans fat right on location. Now, there's other things that'll do it to you. Cholesterol in your diet, 270 milligrams a day. How many milligrams of cholesterol are in one egg? 213, that's right. So a little more cholesterol than is in one egg will increase your risk of diabetes 60%. Oh, but I heard eggs were better than regular cholesterol. Is that true? I saw a recent study that showed that if you ate one egg a day, your risk of diabetes went up 65 to 70%. So no, eggs are actually worse. And then if you're getting most of your fat from animal sources, that is saturated fat, say 36% of your calories coming from this source, then your risk of diabetes goes up 64%. That's people. In laboratory animals, when they fed them 75% of their calories as fat, their risk of diabetes went up 300%. So fat is a huge cause. Why is that? Well, we'll show you why here in a little bit. But first of all, there are some good fats. Eaten naturally in their natural habitat, such as nuts. In fact, one serving of nuts a day, or five times a week or plus, will decrease the risk of diabetes by 30%. And this study was on what nuts people had already eaten. So you can go figure what they're eating. Nowadays, they've been doing some new studies on nuts, and they're usually looking at the raw almonds as being the best. And so if you're looking for a certain nut with a biggest bang for your buck, oh, news item! How are we going to tell the people we found the weapons of mass destruction? Remember Desert Storm? And there they are, cheeseburgers, French fries. Now, how many American soldiers died in the Vietnam War? I got 70,000 over here. That's over a 13-year period. How many people do you think die every year of these things in America? Close to 300,000, according to a JAMA article. And so these things, and this is every year. I mean, why aren't we out picketing fast food restaurants? Stop the war! Stop the killing! Bring the troops home! You know? Well, yeah. And the meat products are part of the problem. Milk and meat. Remember when they put these, you know, these charts on schoolroom walls for food groups, the grains, the milks, the meats, and the fruits and vegetables? You know, those were not a predecessor to the food pyramid. The people putting together the food pyramid are in the government. Those guys were just plain putting out advertisements. This was a, you know, advertising campaign to sell more product, especially milk and meat. And they confused a whole generation of Americans who now believe that, oh, if I don't eat, you know, a big bunch of meat for lunch, I'm going to be protein deficient. That's a lie, as we'll find out tomorrow when we talk about cancer. But all this milk and meat makes you insulin resistant. The insulin can no longer push sugar into the cells, and so you end up with diabetes. And it's true, you know, fast food joints. Most of them don't sell a lot of broccoli. They sell animal products. And if you eat at one of those joints twice a week, not twice a day, twice a week, you double your risk of diabetes right there. So look out. Big smile, big problems. Okay, let's talk about some of the stimulants for a little bit. What does this lady have in her hands? Coffee. And what's the thing we worry about in coffee? Caffeine. And why do people like caffeinated beverages? They're addictive, huh? Yeah, gives them an upper, gives them some energy, wakes them up in the morning, all right. But where does all that energy come from? Caffeine doesn't have any calories. Coffee doesn't have much calories. Yes, and where's that energy come from and what form? It comes from your liver in the form of glucose. And so for the diabetic, drinking caffeinated beverages can raise your blood sugar by 28%. You just made it go up, increased your risk of diabetes as well. Alcohol burns out your pancreas, the source of insulin, and that's not good. And then narcotics fight with insulin for the insulin receptors, and that's not good. More insulin resistance. And smoking also has a role. It'll make diabetes more likely. Well, okay. Now, we said if you eat pounds and pounds of sugar, it didn't have a magic effect on you to cause diabetes. But let me tell you, there's one sugar that will. It's not a good sugar. It's fructose. Fructose is the biggest cause of obesity, hypertension, diabetes, cancer, autoimmune diseases, of anything we've taken on in our diets in the last 30 years. And so one fructose sweetened soft drink per day can increase your risk of diabetes by 83%. Have you seen sodas come up in a number of my talks? Americans prefer soda to juices and water these days, and they're paying for it. The psychology of diabetes. 9/10 of disease originates in the mind, does it not? Diabetes is no exception. A big study out of Canada showed that type A personalities have more diabetes. Well, what are type A personalities? They're the driven people. They want to get things done. They push everybody else to get things done. They give everybody else stress. And so stress will do it to you. It increases abdominal obesity, central obesity, you know, spare tire, increases diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So much so that, you know, the relationship between obesity and stress and diabetes has to be given a new name. This is vocabulary class now, diabesity. It's a contraction between the word obesity and diabetes. And there's such a powerful connection between those, we needed this word. And that word is in the medical literature now, diabesity. Well, the more you weigh, the higher your risk of diabetes. For those who are underweight, their lifetime risk of diabetes is only 7%. But for those who are very obese, the risk of diabetes is 57%. In other words, over half of very obese people will come down with diabetes in their lifetime. Well, let's look at it on a map. Here's obesity trends in the United States in 1991. Here's diabetes trends for the same time period. Let's look at Mississippi, for example. The darkest color is the largest population of obese people. And the darkest color, again, largest number of diabetics. We go 10 years later, Mississippi again leads the pack with a large number of obese people and a large number of diabetics. CDC quit doing the charts like that, started doing them like this, but you can still see the same area, you know, we have lots of people who are obese, 2007, and lots of people with diabetes. We can follow it on the maps. Now, does anybody know what this machine is? Close. It's the CAT scan, that's right. This is a CAT scan. This lady's about to go sliding through the CAT scan. It's going to take a picture right through the middle of her. So we're like this. And so here we have the belly button up here. Backbone down here, she's laying flat, and a kidney here, and a kidney here, and a bunch of intestines. Notice there's a little fat around the outside, that's to be expected, and a little bit of fat around the kidney, that's also to be expected. But let's look at somebody who's a type 2 diabetic and obese. Notice all the extra fat around the outside. But I'm not quite so worried about that fat so much as the fat that's on the inside. Oh, look at all the extra fat around the organs. We call this visceral fat or organ fat. This fat is dangerous. Now, if we came around with a thermometer today and stuck it under your tongues and checked your temperature, if you're normal, it should be somewhere around 98.6. That would be good. That would be fine. But that's the temperature under your tongue. Guess what? The temperature down deep inside you, which we call your core temperature, is higher, maybe around 100 degrees. Well, now what happens if I take a chunk of meat, trim the fat off of it, and put it out here in the sun at 90, 100 degrees? Say it was 100 degrees. 100 degrees for a few days. What happens to that fat? Does it smell good? Goes rotten. We call it rancid, right? Goes rancid. Well, that's not good. And that's exactly what's happening inside the person all the time. This fat down here is always going rancid. It puts off rancid products through your bloodstream. Those rancid products we call free radicals, oxidized fats, lipid peroxidation. Those free radicals go around, they increase macular degeneration, hearing loss, Alzheimer's, and I can't remember the rest. No. Kidney disease and heart disease and all kinds of all the complications of diabetes increase with more and more of this visceral fat. One thing you have going in your favor, though, is if you start losing weight, that is some of the first fat to go. So take heart. All right, now there's another problem, and that is each fat cell that you have in your body gets bigger when you gain weight. It doesn't divide. By the time you're like 4 years old, you don't make any more fat cells. And so, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And they get very full. And when they're full, they don't want to eat anymore. This is sort of like you ate Thanksgiving lunch. And after the lunch, you can't decide if you're stuffed or the turkey was stuffed. But, of course, you don't eat turkey. But anyway, you're definitely full. And you decide, well, okay, I know that I should work a bit to get rid of some of these calories. So I'm going to take a walk. So you go waddling down the road. And your neighbor sees you. And they wait. You come over here and you come over. And they're just sitting down to their Thanksgiving dinner. And so they say, hey, come on over here, and do you see that dish there? That's one that only my grandmother makes. And here, somebody get him a plate. He's got to try some of this. Here, pull up a chair, and you're like, wait, I didn't come over to eat. I'm out here exercising to burn off my own lunch. I can't handle it. Put it in the doggy bag for me. And that's exactly what your fat cells say to your body. No more food. Read my lips. And when the cells won't take on sugar, the sugar accumulates in the bloodstream. Your pancreas keeps trying to make more insulin to push the sugar into your cells, and it doesn't work. Let's look at this on a physiology slide. This is a capillary, the smallest blood vessel in your body, so small that only one red blood cell at a time can go through the capillary. Now, in your body, cells all sit on a capillary somewhere where they can interact with the outside world. This is a normal cell. He's normal. He's happy. He's just a little bit hungry, not a lot hungry. And so he puts out some insulin receptors so that insulin can come along and bind to the receptor and sugar can move into the cell. You see, the insulin receptor is sort of like a doorknob. Insulin is sort of like the doorkeeper. And so when there's a doorknob there and the doorkeeper's available, the doorkeeper opens the door and the sugar moves into the cell. That's the way it works. Notice I only put one receptor out there where the body could take advantage of it. The rest of the receptors are pulled in because he's not that hungry. But then you have an overfed fat cell, totally filled up. He pulls all his insulin receptors inside. Along comes the insulin, the doorkeeper. There's no doorknobs there to open, so the sugar accumulates in the bloodstream. You see how that works? You end up with a cell that's totally filled up. Now, question for you, what is going to fill that cell up the quickest? What's going to fill it up the fastest, carbohydrate or fat? Which has more calories, carbohydrate or fat? Fat. By how much? More than twice as much, right? Carbohydrate has 4, fat has 9. Any wonder why fat causes insulin resistance? Any wonder why fat fills the cells up twice as fast? Any wonder why fat causes diabetes? There it is. Well, and then the diabetic, they start exercising. When they start exercising, the cell gets hungry. When the cell gets hungry, it puts all of its insulin receptors down in the bloodstream. When it puts all its insulin receptors down, the insulin can come along and bind to the receptors, and the sugar moves in to the cell. What did I say made the cells hungry again? Exercise. That's right. That's going to be on the quiz. Did I tell you there's going to be a quiz? Okay, there's going to be a quiz. Okay, well, what are some of the consequences if my blood sugar goes up? Well, immediate consequences is that my triglycerides go up. Well, now, why is that? I mean, I thought triglycerides were like oils. It is. And sugar is like carbohydrate. How's come if I eat too much carbohydrate or get too much carbohydrate in my blood, my sugar, my oils go up? You know, they're not the same. Well, your body can't store sugar cubes. Sugar tends to turn to crystals. Your body doesn't have a way of handling those. It needs to be in sort of a liquid form. And so it changes it into triglycerides. And thus the high triglycerides. Proteins are glycated. What's that mean? The proteins get sugar-coated. Oh, sugar-coated. That sounds good. Not if it's your blood cells and blood vessels and nerves and muscles and insulin goes up. Well, that stands to reason, of course. Insulin goes up because it's trying to push the sugar into the cell. Well, guess what? Insulin is not there just to put sugar in the cells. Insulin has other jobs too. It does other things, like make you grow. It is a growth factor. And, well, it needs building blocks to make things grow, so your cholesterol goes up, your blood pressure goes up, so everybody will get growing, and guess what else starts growing? Yes, tumors. Oh, tumors. For example, breast cancer tissue usually has about twice the number of insulin receptors hanging out as normal breast tissue. It's learned to take advantage of all this extra insulin. And it tends to make you fat, particularly around the middle. So, very interesting. Now, it also messes with your immune system. On a good day, your white cell's job is to eat bad bacteria, such as E. coli, Staph aureus, Streptococcus, and so forth. But if you start eating sugar, they can't do their job. If you eat no sugar in a 12-hour period, then each white cell can eat 14 bacteria. 14 bad bacteria that would otherwise have caused you trouble. But now, if you start eating sugar, say 12 teaspoons of sugar, what's a common food with 12 teaspoons of sugar? Yeah, a cola, a soda, something like that. All right, you go eating that sugar, you just reduce the number of bacteria that each white cell can consume by 60%, down to 5.5. You eat another 12 teaspoons of sugar, and that number drops to 1. And guess how many teaspoons of sugar the average American eats in a day? 53, according to one study. We import 150 pounds per person per year. So, go figure. Well, all right, so everybody's way immunosuppressed. We're going to talk about that some more tomorrow, because when you're immunosuppressed, you start getting lumps and bumps in odd places. Well, let's talk about the way we measure sugar, or the way we calculate it, the way we figure it. We have what we call the glycemic index. Glycemic index, what's that mean? Glycemic means sugar, index means comparison, so it's a comparison to sugar. For example, pure table sugar has a glycemic index of 100, meaning that it makes your blood sugar go up 100% as high and as fast as pure sugar. Stands to reason, it's the standard, 100. So everything else is a percentage thereof. So, for example, corn flakes and milk has a glycemic index of 93, meaning that corn flakes and milk makes your blood sugar go up 93% percent as high and as fast as pure sugar. Broccoli has a glycemic index of 20, meaning that it only makes your blood sugar go up 20% as high and as fast as pure sugar. So basically, glycemic index tells you what a certain carbohydrate will do to your blood sugar. A high glycemic index food raises your blood sugar really high, really fast. And so we use the glycemic index. And then we do experiments. For example, if we feed laboratory animals high glycemic index foods, we can see what happens. For example, rats fed a high glycemic index diet developed marked obesity in 32 weeks. You ever see a fat rat running around out in the countryside? No, there is one. The eagle sees him first, right? He's a goner. Well, and if people eat this high glycemic index food, they eat a larger volume, they feel less satisfied, and they get hungry sooner, and they come back for more. Cha-ching, I just sold another Twinkie, or whatever. It sells food. Sounds like the prescription for an addiction, doesn't it? We talked about this in the obesity talk, didn't we? Yes, and then the people get the stuff that has no nutrition and they crave more food. There's another principle to add to this. There's a difference between eating 2 pounds of sugar and eating a teaspoon, okay? So we have another factor we call glycemic load. It takes into consideration the volume of a high glycemic index food. And so here's some high glycemic index and load, excuse me, high glycemic load foods. Burger and fries and hot dog and fries. Whoa, I thought those were protein meals. Oh, for sure, there's a little chunk of protein there, but look at all the white carbohydrate, white buns and white potatoes fried really hot. And then here is some corn chips. But they told me my corn chips were whole grain. I have a video at home of somebody working in a corn chip factory, one of my patients. And he loads up a bunch of bags of cornmeal and pours them into big cookers and puts water in there and starts them cooking. And cooking 1 hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 10 hours, 20 hours, 27 hours later, they finally stop. Whoa, what happens to your broccoli if you cook it too long? Yeah, and so 27 hours of cooking this stuff. Well, when you cook it that long, you break down complex carbohydrates into simple carbohydrates, complex sugars into simple sugars, to where at the end of this process, it makes it a very high glycemic load or index food, refined in the process of cooking. And here's sodas and cookies and pastries and white pasta. White potatoes, and the longer you cook them and the hotter you cook them, the higher the glycemic index goes. I mean, I wouldn't eat them raw, but, you know, just be aware of that. A lot of diabetics can't handle potatoes. White bread and white rice. On the other hand, let's look at low glycemic load foods. We're looking at tofu and olives and vegetables, especially salads and avocados and sprouts and raw almonds and all the different vegetables and peas and beans and brown rice instead of white rice and brown bread instead of white bread and oatmeal instead of cornflakes and milk and apples and fresh fruit. Wait. They told me when I became a diabetic that I couldn't have any more fruit, that I had to limit myself to one piece per day and to be very careful. Well, I'm not recommending the diabetic become a fruitarian, but there's some things in fruit you don't want to be without. And when you eat the fruit raw, not canned, not cooked, not dried, with all its fiber and minerals and phytochemicals and good things, it can be very good for you. Now, you might have to pick certain ones initially until you get over your diabetes that don't cause your blood sugar to go too high, but as you'll see tomorrow, we want our fruit. Now, let's just look at different fruits with that in mind. Here is a glass of orange juice. Here is an orange. And so let's think about our glass of orange juice. Now, this is some of the best orange juice you can buy down here at the supermarket. I mean, they wanted to make sure you had the best orange juice. So they do want you to come back for more, and they want it to be good by the time you get to eat it. So they've done something special to it, so it won't go bad. They call it pasteurization, which means they heated it up until it killed all offending bacteria. Well, when they heated it up, they changed a lot of the complex sugars and starches into simple sugars. And by the time they're done, the sugar profile of orange juice is actually worse than soda pop. Oh, I know it has some vitamins and some minerals and some other things that might make it have some redeeming value, but as far as the sugar goes, it's got more free sugar in it than most soda pop. Okay, well, let's see what happens here. Let's start here at time zero. Let's drink our orange juice. Whoa, up goes the sugar, way high, way up here. And then it doesn't stay up there very long. It goes flying down, 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 down. Way down in the bottom. Oh, I'm just feeling so weak and tired. I must be low on blood sugar. Would somebody go get me another orange juice? That's what diabetics do all day long. Up and down, up and down. But let's change the picture. Let's start over. Instead of drinking the orange juice, let's try the orange. Now, this orange is a good orange. It, of course, hasn't been pasteurized. It's fresh. It still has all the pulp, has all the fiber, has all the sections, has all the minerals, vitamins. Hasn't been heated up. And so when you eat it, you have a very different situation. The sugar comes up, but it doesn't go up so high so fast. It stays up, but stays up a long time. And not only does it stay up a long time, it comes down slowly and doesn't go crashing down in the basement. That is important. Well, let's look at this on a whole day, okay? Here we have a similar situation. We have insulin and glucose graft. Here we have the danger zone. You don't want to go too low. And concentration up here. Let's start off with a refined cereal breakfast. After all, we are refined people. So we will have a refined breakfast, thank you. So cornflakes and milk, okay? All right, cornflakes and milk. And so just like drinking the orange juice, up goes the sugar, and the insulin, which is in red here, goes way high. It overshoots. It thinks there's going to be an emergency, all that sugar coming in there so fast. And it drives the sugar down deep into the danger zone. Oh, I'm just feeling so faint. What's for break time? Anybody brought something good? Oh, coffee and donuts. Up goes the sugar. Up goes the insulin. Down goes the sugar. Down in the basement. Deep down in the basement. Oh, I'm just feeling so faint. What's for lunch? Oh, burger and fries, high protein rich lunch, but it's all refined carbohydrate, no fiber, no good stuff, and so we're in trouble again. And diabetics just do this all day long. So what do they tell the diabetics? Well, why don't you just eat little tiny meals all day long, and pretty soon this green jaggedy line will stay up here somewhere, and you'll solve the problem. Does it work? Well, of sorts. At least it does sort of keep the blood sugar up all day long so it doesn't go down. Is it good for you? Well, let's ask the stomach. The stomach's job is to take the food that you so thoroughly masticated, chewed, and mix other things with it. So it's just the right pH, just the right osmolality, right amount of water, just the right consistency so it can go on to the small intestine. And so as soon as that cornflakes and milk hits your stomach, it starts going swish, swish, swish. Oh, so much fluid. I got to absorb a bunch of this fluid. Swish, 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 swish. Okay, the fluid's just about absorbed. Whoa, what's this? Coffee and donuts? What'd you do that for? Yuck. Okay, more liquid. Gotta absorb that coffee stuff. Oh, this makes me irritated. Coffee makes me have peptic ulcers. Oh, swish, swish, swish. And just as it's just about to absorb the coffee, here comes burger and fries. Oh, yuck. Grease and coffee now. Oh, you make my job so hard. And the people who study this are the pharmaceutical industry people. They give a patient pills in the morning before breakfast, then the person eats breakfast, then a mid-morning snack, and lunch, and a mid-afternoon snack, and supper, and then they check their stomach, and 13 hours later, the pills are still there, along with some of the breakfast, which isn't looking all that appetizing anymore. And besides, compared to a two-meal-a-day program, colon cancer risk rises 70% for 3 meals a day, 90% for 4 meals a day. What's more, each additional snack time increases the risk of colon cancer another 60%. Which would you rather die of, colon cancer or complications of diabetes? Well, neither one, thank you. Okay, well, you can avoid both of them. But eating little meals all day isn't going to fix the problem. It just changes it into another problem. So let's change the picture. Let's start all over again. Let's start off with a whole grain, unrefined breakfast. Good food. Oh, let's say oatmeal or granola, okay? Oatmeal or granola. And so just like eating the orange instead of drinking the orange juice, the glucose comes up very slowly. Not only does it come up slowly, it stays up a long time. Not only does it stay up a long time, it comes down more slowly. And then we know somewhere in here we're going to eat a fresh vegetable lunch, and then the glucose will come up more slowly again. stay up a long time. You see, this is the secret to getting the diabetic's sugar under control. When I was watching the Wemar program, Reversing Diabetes, we'd feed them all this good food in the morning, and these people who had usually eaten two or three meals by lunchtime came to lunch and they said, "It's lunchtime? Really? I'm not even hungry. Are you sure?" Because they were eating good, whole plant foods. Now, sugar, it clogs the system. It's very bad about clogging the system. I mean, you heard of the tar baby and Brer Rabbit? This is bad news. Too much glucose clogs the blood vessels. Let's have a blood vessel here and let's add sugar. The sugar starts to coat the inside of the blood vessel. More sugar, more coating. Pretty soon the coating gets very thick. Let's blow it up really big. Here's the sugar coating on the blood vessel. Here's a red blood cell. The red blood cell gets coated with sugar. We call it hemoglobin A1C. Anybody ever heard of hemoglobin A1C? Yeah. Yeah, this is the way we tell if you're diabetic or not. And here's a high hemoglobin A1C. Well, this is a huge problem. These things get stuck in this stuff. Sugar sticks to sugar. It's like taffy. And it's very hard to get nutrition out here where you need it to the tissues. That's why diabetics are always getting amputations, because no nutrients can make it out here to the tissues. And so hemoglobin A1C basically tells us what your glucose was like over the last 3 months. If it goes up to 6.5, it's another diagnostic indicator of diabetes. But it's supposed to be around 5 or below. And if it goes over 5, it predicts increased risk of heart disease. I mean, if it goes up by 1% from 5 to 6, your risk of dying of a heart attack goes up by 40%. And a lot of diabetics have it up 10, 12, 13. So they did a big bunch of studies on people who were not diabetic. They found out that 70% of non-diabetics over the age of 45 had a hemoglobin A1C that was too high, meaning that a majority of the complications of high blood sugar are in people who never have been diagnosed with diabetes. In other words, if you are living the lifestyle that would cause somebody else to be diabetic, you could die of diabetic complications even though your blood sugars never go way over 125. So beware of that. On the other hand, if you can get that hemoglobin A1C down by 1%, then you can reduce your risk of diabetic complications such as stroke by 17%, heart attack by 18%, deaths from all causes by 25%. You reduce the risk of retinopathy and blindness by 30%, kidney disease 30%, amputations by 30%. So we're always trying to get the diabetic's hemoglobin A1C down. With pills? Well, in a 4-year study where they aggressively controlled people's blood sugar with pills and insulin, they did get it under control, but it increased their risk of dying by 20%. Pills are not the answer. Pills will kill you, even though they get your blood sugar under control. You want to get your blood sugar under control naturally. Well, how did they used to treat diabetes? Interesting, Hippocrates, whose picture is there, had a saying, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine thy food." How's that for progressive? For way back then. In the year 1000 AD, Greek physicians recommended horseback riding to reduce excessive urination. Oh boy. We don't try that anymore. The Humane Society's way too active. Besides, it's hard to find a good horse. In the 1800s, bleeding, blistering, and doping were common. Can you think of a famous American that was bled to death? George Washington, that's right. He was doing fine in the morning. Came down with flu symptoms by noon. They decided that they were going to call the doctors. After the third set of physicians came by to apply their healing arts on him, bleeding him, he was no longer responding. we say that all bleeding eventually stops when you're dead. In 1915, Sir William Osler recommended opium. Well, if we can't fix them, at least we'll keep them happy. Okay, well, how should we treat diabetes? Let's look at some studies. Here's a very good study. This was on pre-diabetics. In other words, these are people that are most likely to go on to diabetes. Pre-diabetics. And so, first we start with a placebo group. They didn't do anything for them. A lot of them came down with diabetes. The next group got medications. They reduced the incidence of diabetes by 31%. That's good. 31 fewer people out of 100 coming down with diabetes. Well, that made a difference for 31 people. And then in the third group, they did lifestyle changes only, no pills. In that group, they reduced the number of diabetics by 58%. Whoa, what's that mean? You know what that tells me? Lifestyle interventions are a much more powerful medical intervention than pills. Well, it makes sense. Pills didn't cause the diabetes in the first place. Lifestyle did. Reminds me, our head elder in one of our churches, he was in the lobby and one of the ladies came through that was quite overweight, and she says, "Norm, I'm going to lose weight." And he says, "How are you going to do that?" He says, "There's a plan going on downtown. They're dispensing some pills that'll help me lose weight." And he looked at her and he says, "Well, did pills make you fat?" No. And so lifestyle caused it, so lifestyle should fix it. Well, what were their lifestyle changes? Well, they had a weight loss goal of 7%. And remember we said some of the first fat to go was that visceral fat? They had them exercise every day for a total of 150 minutes in the entire week. And they had them eat better food, more fiber, lower fat intake, and lower glycemic load. And this is a three-year study, and that's where they saw this 58% improvement. Lifestyle makes a difference. So let's look at some of these along with other factors that are very, very important. You know, if you lose weight continuously, approaching your ideal body weight, you don't have to go under your ideal body weight, but if you're approaching your ideal body weight, for some people, this can make a 30 to 50% difference alone. Very effective. And exercise. Now, what did we say the exercise did to the cells? It made them hungry again, and when they got hungry, they took on more sugar and insulin, so it lowers insulin and sugar, helps control weight, and improves mental outlook. Get away from the stress. Get out and take a walk. Leave the screaming, crying, whatever's at home. All right, and how much exercise do I need? Well, we recommend, if you're diabetic and you're trying to get over it, at least an hour a day. An hour a day? Wait, there's only 24 of them things, and they have already been consigned to something else. Well, you don't have to have one solid hour. In fact, it's better to break it up. A little here, a little there. And when you do it a little here and a little there, then you get the benefits. Moderate is just as good as intense. You don't have to kill yourself. Just get out and start doing something, and as you do this, what would be the best times? Well, the best times for a diabetic, a good walk, of course moderate, before breakfast. Yeah, some diabetics, if they exercise vigorously in the mid-afternoon, the blood sugar goes too low. This does not happen in the majority of cases when they do their exercise before breakfast. So before breakfast is very good. It also increases the metabolic rate, so you burn more calories. And then immediately after meals, a moderate walk. And this immediately after meals, well, that's been what's made some diabetic programs very famous. And because they think that walk after the meals is what has made the difference for them. And it decreases blood sugar and insulin levels. So there you go. So if you walked 10 to 15 minutes at each of those times, you could get your hour in. Before breakfast, after lunch, after supper, if you're going to eat supper. Okay, and in the studies, those who are very active reduce their incidence or risk of diabetes by 46%. So activity is important. And you know, if you keep wiggling, they won't put you in a box. If you can't find time for exercise, you will have to find time to be sick. Oh, I'd rather exercise. Now, they said they improved their eating. They gave them foods with more fiber. Grains are often a source of more fiber. And so when they looked at replacing all refined grains, which have had the fiber removed, such as white pasta, and replaced it with whole grains, such as whole wheat pasta, they saw a 70% reduction in diabetes right there. You'll see why here in a minute. If you aren't used to eating any grains, and you add a few, like 3 servings of whole grains a day, you can see a reduction of about 50% in the incidence or risk of diabetes. Now, fiber is a part of grains. It's also a part of vegetables. Fiber is extremely important. Eat more high-fiber foods. It helps to fight constipation. Oh, who wants to die of constipation? Well, what kind of disease do you get if you get constipation? Colon cancer? Hemorrhoids? Diverticulitis? Irritable bowel? And guess what? Parkinson's patients are chronically dehydrated and constipated most of their lives, even 20 years before they come down with a brain disorder. All right, high cholesterol comes down with fiber. So does heart disease because of the cholesterol. Blood sugars and diabetes decrease with more fiber. One of my colleagues had a patient come in to him who had diabetes from being pregnant. We call it gestational diabetes. And she read over the list of medications she could take and their side effects, and she said, no, I don't want any of those for my baby. But she looked at the side effects of having high blood sugar, and she's like, well, I don't want that for my baby either. What to do? What to do? Dilemma, dilemma. What do I do? And so my colleague said, well, I got an idea. We can try something. Go home. Get some oat bran. I want you to eat a half cup of oat bran 3 times a day. Whoa, that's a lot of oat bran. But she took it as a challenge. She got creative. She started making everything with oat bran. Oat bran cookies, oat bran muffins, oat bran waffles, oat bran bread, oat bran everything. And it totally controlled her blood sugar throughout her pregnancy. She delivered a normal baby and had no complications. Fiber slows the rate at which blood sugar moves from the intestine into the bloodstream. And so fiber is very helpful. Now, in the program I just suggested to you, the patient sent a fiber chaser after their usual high glycemic meal. It worked, but I recommend just eating food that has not had the fiber removed. And so here's a study that confirms what we just said, why he chose to do that. Comparing white bread to oat bran bread, people eating oat bran bread saw their insulin requirements drop and their blood sugars dropped by 46%. So oat bran is very good. But there's another factor about grains besides the bran that's helpful, and that is the minerals. You know, most of the minerals are in the bran, the outside part that they polish off when they make rice, white rice, and whole wheat into white wheat. There is a white wheat that's whole wheat, but, you know, I'm talking about white flour. Okay, so chromium is one of those minerals. And guess what? Diabetics generally have no tissue chromium. Why? Were they born without it? Are they allergic to it? No. It's because if you're eating refined carbohydrates that have no chromium, but it takes chromium to get the sugar into the cell, your body's going to use all its own stores of chromium just to get all that sugar into the cells, and you're going to be totally depleted of chromium. And then, oh, remember in the cholesterol talk we said, up goes your LDL and down goes your HDL. In this diabetes talk, up goes your sugar way high. And so 100% whole wheat is a good place to start replenishing. 100% whole wheat has 8 times the chromium of white flour. Brown rice has 4 times the chromium as white rice. So, good chromium sources. You don't want to be low on those. I just want to mention one vegetable that's very good, and that's cabbage. Cabbage tends to be an insulin potentiator. I mean, it stretches your insulin, makes it go farther, makes you more insulin sensitive. And so we've even had good success with this in some type 1 diabetics. It's sort of the key to getting them off their insulin. And all right, quiz time. Did I tell you it was going to be a quiz? Yeah. All right. Your job is to identify whole plant foods, foods that have not been refined, foods that haven't had things removed, foods that are not animal foods, foods that will make you healthy, foods that will take away your diabetes. All right. Whole plant food? Okay, you pass. This one? No. Grease sticks? That causes diabetes. Yes, good. Whole fruit? No. Cream puffs or white biscuits? No, that's not helpful. Triscuits? Sort of a trick question. If you read the ingredients, would it not have a bunch of oil? Yeah, so the oil is bad, and so no, it's not a whole plant food because it's got ingredients in it that are quite refined and quite a bit of part of the problem. And they may claim that there's no trans fat, but by the time they're through frying that thing, which is essentially what happens to it. I mean, I know they run it through an oven at high heat and with a lot of oil on it, and they didn't get it near a frying pan, but it's still basically fried. You've got trans fat, and that's a big part of the problem. No. Okay, we talked about these. Yeah, trick question. Okay. Nuts? All right. Yes, good stuff. No. Oatmeal? All right, beans. Spaghetti! Because it's white, right? Yeah. But you can get whole grain spaghetti. Here's some spelt spaghetti. And, oh, but I hate that stuff, right? Doesn't taste like the other. Well, put yourself on a transitional diet. Start out with 10% whole grain and 90% of the white stuff. And then next time, 20, 80, and 30, 70. You know, work your way that way. And by the time you're down to 10% white and 90% whole wheat, after a while you get to where you can't stand the tasteless, slobbery white stuff. So, all right. That takes some changes. All right, is this stuff good? No, not a whole plant food. Corn? Yeah, corn's good. How about corn chips? Corn syrup? No. Eggs? No. White tortillas? You can get whole wheat ones, can't you? Ezekiel makes some really good ones. You know Ezekiel Bread Company is an Adventist company? Toasting your bread lowers the glycemic index. Isn't that interesting? Makes it so the carbohydrate doesn't go rushing in your bloodstream so fast. Now, if you're trying to get over diabetes, you definitely want to eat breakfast. People who eat breakfast regularly eat fewer calories for the day, have lower cholesterols, and 50% lower risk of diabetes. So eat your breakfast and chew your food well. If you thoroughly chew your food, and you choose foods that require chewing, a signal is sent to your pancreas to put insulin out ahead of time, so your blood sugar never goes as high. You're prepared for it. So, you know, you don't have to chew things like smoothies and juice and Twinkies. So choose things that get your teeth into the process early on in your meal. Shall I sleep? Sleep is important. People who don't get their sleep or get too much sleep have more diabetes. Vitamin D. Deficiency of vitamin D is linked to type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And on the other hand, studies have looked at supplements and it's helped. We recommend getting your sunshine. Water. Question for you. Which is sweeter, a grape or a raisin? Why? It's more concentrated. It's dehydrated. So who do you think has a higher blood sugar? Somebody who has been drinking their water or has not been drinking their water? Yeah, if you're not drinking your water, you will have a higher blood sugar. So you can lower your blood sugar by sheer dilution, just by drinking more water. One study, they could raise the blood volume by 6%, so you can drop your blood sugar. Water is hugely important. I practiced up at Parkview Adventist Medical Center in Maine. The employees of the hospital were using too much of their insurance, in which the hospital had a financial risk. And so the CEO of the hospital came out, and, oh, what do we do? What do we do? He came to the wellness department. What do we do? And the wellness nurse said, let's try something. Let's put bottled water in all the break rooms. Okay, let's do it. And so for that year, they put bottled water in all of the break rooms. Every Thursday morning, the man with the forklift would come around from Central Supply and drop off cases and cases of bottled water. It cost the hospital $24,000 to keep water in all the break rooms. And at break time, we would get out of surgery, we'd come to the break room, we'd grab a bottle of water and drink it down. Everybody sit around and drink water. Who wants to go to the pop machine if water's free? Nobody went down to the cafeteria to get other beverages. And so they drank lots of water. At the end of the year, when they calculated it all up, they had reduced insurance utilization by the employees of the hospital by $240,000. And it happened the next year and the next year. Water drinking is extremely important. And that was bottled water. Some people argue whether that's good for you or not. Hey, there you go. All right. Decreases diabetic peripheral neuropathy. That's one of the few things that's been shown to reverse the peripheral neuropathy. Okay, in summary, what do we do to reverse our diabetes? Let's get regular exercise in the open air and sunshine. Let's eat an unrefined plant-based diet, low in fat, high in fiber, high in all the minerals, high in all the phytochemicals, high in all the antioxidants. And let's make weight control a habit. Let's drink plenty of water. Get adequate sleep. Avoid stimulants such as coffee, tea, alcohol, tobacco. And stress? I know somebody who can handle that stress. He's volunteered to do it too. Yeah, that's right, the Lord. Well, does it work? How's it worked? Have they studied it? Sure have. Diabetic patients were put on a 25-day program, essentially a month, with a special diet, exercise program, New Start program, adequate sunshine, rest, pure filtered water. Patients were fed an unrefined plant-based diet, low in fat, that's 10 to 15% of calories coming from fat, high in fiber with no cholesterol. Results, average weight loss, 11 pounds, that's pretty good for a month. One-fourth no longer needed insulin or drugs to control their blood sugar. That's in 1 month. On out about 6 months, the numbers improved quite a bit. Those who still needed insulin saw their requirements cut nearly in half. Blood pressure dropped from a high 155 over 81 to a better 132 over 77. And 81% had complete relief of the peripheral neuropathy, pain or numbness in the hands or feet. Diabetes is one of the most treatable diseases with lifestyle interventions. Well, what kind of diet have we been talking about? It's the original diet, is it not? Yes, then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food, and you'll eat the plants of the field. Well, the original diet. Now, do you recall that we said that the Egyptians had diabetes, and that when God released the Israelites, He told them that if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, I will put none of these diseases upon thee which I brought upon the Egyptians. If they had stuck with that original diet, they could totally avoid diabetes. Well, do you understand now why I gave this talk the title, Diabetes, the Butter with the Sweet? It's the fats, the oils, the greases that fill the cells up the fastest, so you're insulin resistant. But it's the sugars that cause all the complications because they have no place to go. The cells are full and the sugar can't go in the cell. Does that make sense? Help me understand that. Good, good. All right. Very good. Now, everything we talk about here so far, except for the first lecture, is on our DVD series. And you can take these and run a program at your local church, or copy them off and send it to your resistant relative who you've always been wanting to clobber. No, don't you dare do that. Be nice. Say, oh, I have something wonderful to share with you. And all right. So our website, you can print out this lecture, and there's more usually in my handouts than in my lecture. And try a new recipe. Watch this online. Email the link to your friend to watch it online. All right, time for questions. And we've got a microphone here. Who has a question? Oh, we got a couple microphones. All right, looks like we got somebody over here that's got their hand up. Very good. Smile, you're on candid camera.
No. every day this week you've mentioned drinking water, and I have got to tell you, I think I've drank at least a half a gallon of just water every day this week because, you know, I felt like I had to do that. But I would like to know, what amount do you recommend typically?
Good question. How much water shall I drink? The simplest answer is drink enough water so your urine comes out relatively clear. The reason I say that's the simplest answer is because all the formulas, unless they take into account your activity level and the temperature outside, sometimes fall short and sometimes are sort of long. But a rule of thumb that some people came up with is take your weight in pounds, divide it by 2, and then drink that much in ounces. So if you weigh 100 pounds, you drink 50 ounces. You weigh 200 pounds, you drink 100 ounces. So it's easy to calculate that way. But on the charts, if the temperature's up around 100 degrees and you're very active, you might need 2-3 gallons of water. But you probably need a little salt with that. I spent some time down the Amazon working on some sort of like Maranatha project, and it seemed like we would drink a 2-liter bottle of water and it would just pour off of us. And so temperature makes a difference, so it's variable.
Okay, I have two questions. One of them is, it doesn't really have anything to do with diabetes, but I had been talking to somebody and they were questioning this, and I just thought I'd ask you, does drinking soy milk or eating tofu increase estrogen in men?
Does it increase estrogen in men? Good question. The reason that question comes up is because soy products pose a significant financial risk to a certain other industry, and that other industry has a lot of money to throw around, and they hired propaganda machine in Washington, D.C. called the Weston A. Price Foundation. And Weston A. Price's foundation is to throw out all kinds of, you know, decoys against soy. It's very interesting that soybeans have phytoestrogens, but only 2/3 as much phytoestrogens as flax. But flax doesn't come under all this flack because it doesn't pose a significant financial risk to milk. So that said, the people who eat the most soy in the world are the Okinawans. They also originated karate. They aren't a bunch of men that look like women. You got one standing right next to you here.
Yeah.
And so we don't think that that's an issue. In fact, so much so, I'll mention it tomorrow, soy is a significant, a soldier for fighting against breast cancer. Because it has phytoestrogen properties, it blocks estrogen receptors from getting stimulated by the stronger estrogens, such as estradiol. And so it makes it so you have less of a potential of getting cancer. And so all this stuff about if you give your kids who are boys soy, you can change them into girls is totally fictitious.
Okay. The other one is you mentioned about the cooking the corn. And they cooked it for like 27 hours, but then we're told to cook our grains for a long period of time, like the oatmeal and things. We don't want to just cook them quickly. So what is the difference, and where is the time frame different with cooking the grains and the cooking the corn for a long time?
Yes, good question. How long should I cook my grains? Our counsel is to cook them for at least an hour, which is far shorter than 27 hours. And so that's the good recommendation. Of course, the temperature makes a difference, but most of the time the temperature in water is going to be somewhere around boiling. And so you don't make much difference whether you make it boil fast or slow. I think you can cook your grains way too much and end up with a high glycemic index food. Just like the potatoes, the longer you cook them, the hotter you cook them, the more the glycemic index goes up. So, does that include granola when you cook it overnight? No, it's a different process there. When you're cooking grains in water, you have the effect of hydrolyzation. You end up causing hydrolysis, breaking of bonds between the different starches and letting them go free. When you dry cook, you're evaporating off the water, and the thing isn't going to turn into separate sugars, just like toasting your bread. It kind of has what we call the Millard effect, after Dr. Millard, who studied browning of carbohydrates. And so cooking your granola a long time doesn't have the same effect. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. Okay, last question here.
This is not actually a question. It's a suggestion that might help those who have trouble fitting in their exercise. Whenever you go to the Walmart or the grocery store or someplace, don't look for the place closest to the door. Park all the way at the other end of the parking lot and walk. And you'll be surprised how much exercise you'll get. Take the stairs and wherever you're going, park a ways away and walk. And you'll be surprised how much you can add to your exercise that way.
There you go. All the Adventists will be fighting for the parking spot way out in the back. And nobody will bang your car with their door.
Thank you very much, Dr. Clark. Appreciate you. Let's just bow our heads. Father in heaven, again, we just thank you so much for this marvelous body that you have created. And Lord, all these new things that we've learned to take care of these bodies to your glory and your honor. Thank you for blessing us, blessing each one now, and bringing us back at 7 o'clock in Jesus' name. Amen.